Welcome, listeners, to Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy, here every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time with you on the Progressive Radio Network. Every week on Connect the Dots, we connect the dots between your personal health and well-being and our total environment. In order to be healthy, for years we've talked about personal health, and we still talk about personal health, but health and well-being happens within the context for life, the greater global context, the health of our food, water, air, and earth, the health of our communities, the health of our society, and the ecological balance of planet Earth are all key to our well-being and that of our children and future generations, and that's what we talk about every single week on Connect the Dots. This week is an exciting one because next week we're going to be having Climate Week in New York. This is an annual event that happens every year. It's around a summit that occurs at the United Nations. I personally love it because all of the great environmentalists come to town. It'll be occurring this coming week in New York, September 21st through September 28th. And there are a lot of exciting events. You can go and find out more at climateweeknyc.org. And among those participating, presenting, and, you know, kind of observing and having input into what will be going on this year and what the critical issues are my guests for today's show. Really delighted to have him back again. He's been a guest multiple times. He is the CEO and president of Penn Future, and he'll be telling us more about that. A former president and CEO of the National Wildlife Federation for many years, Larry Schweiger. He's really been a longstanding, senior, committed voice, advocate, mover and shaker in the entire climate awareness and addressing climate movement. I follow him and came to know him originally as a Facebook friend, and really stay in touch with all of the developments through his wisdom and through his leadership. And so he's going to tell us a bit about what are the key issues going into Climate Week, as well as discuss his new role at Penn Future. Welcome back to Connect the Dots, Larry Schweiger.
Thank you, Allison. It's great to be with you.
So just tell us, you know, we're heading into Climate Week, and, you know, in my perception, more and more people are aware of the issue. It's a year out from the climate march in New York. And yet, you know, give us an update. How much we now have the Pope, who has spoken out on this issue and is really taking leadership on our need to address and really make this a global priority. Without a doubt, there's increase in awareness, I think, from, you know, what has existed in the past. But where are we? How far along are we in really grappling with and addressing the serious issues that have to be dealt with in order to, I don't even know if it's possible, but even to stop this, but to even soften its effects or be prepared to deal with it? Where are we now in your view?
Well, starting with the planet, which is a good place to start, I think, you know, it's clear that we have missed the mark. You know, I think back to my first climate talk was more than 25 years ago. I actually gave a talk in Colorado on climate change. It was after James Hansen had testified before the Senate and a number of other documents were produced. The White House under Jimmy Carter made it clear that climate change was a threat. You know, we've had a long, long, even going back to President Lyndon Baines Johnson, we've known that putting carbon dioxide in the sky is disruptive and will cause problems. And we, as a society and as a planetary population, have ignored those warnings. Soft as they were at first and then getting more and more clear, more and more aggressive. The scientists have been for decades warning us, and I thought we had enough information back in 1988 to start acting on climate change. I was foolish to think that, but I believed that we had enough science in and a prudent person would do everything possible to avoid the calamity that would be bestowed on our children. We ignored that, and because we've ignored the warnings that have come fast and repeatedly, we are now in a situation where nature is doing two things. One, nature is treating us badly, the droughts in the West, the forest fires throughout the West, all the way from California to Alaska. We're setting new records this year for the number of acres burned, and the Forest Service has warned us that forest fires will double under our current scenario by 2050. So we're going to see twice as many fires or more. Even that may be understated. And we've already seen a fourfold increase in the number of fires and a sixfold increase in the number of acres burned. So we're seeing, you know, very dramatic in this country alone. And then, of course, around the world, we're seeing these persistent droughts that well up. We're seeing sea level rise threatening, you know, literally hundreds of millions of people with their food supplies and their security. And we got some really troubling news this year when a major chunk of ice 5 miles across broke off near Ilulissat in Greenland. And, you know, there's just a lot of really clear warnings that nature is not handling our carbon pollution and is starting to have, have some consequences that will cost us a lot of money, cost us a lot of lives, cost us a lot of well-being. But beyond that, nature is also starting to get into the game itself. As you heat up soils, for example, they give off carbon. Carbon dioxide is that black that we find in our soil. It also is the glue that holds soil together. And as that soil gets overheated, the carbon goes out of the soil. The soil is left with sand, silt, and clay, and then the winds come along and they blow the silt and the clay away, and you have sand. Well, the last time I looked at it, that was a desert. You know, sand is desert. Mm. And we're seeing that happening in places like Arizona, where these hubbubs roar through and whip up silt and clay dust into the air. We're seeing it in other parts of the world as well. Iran has had several recently. And incidentally, the Middle East had temperatures that were just astounding. You know, when they look at the heat index of 165 degrees in one day, I don't know how anybody survives that, to be honest with you. So, you know, nature's starting to react badly. The tundra is warming up and it's giving off methane. There's actually been, I'm aware of about 13 different places in the Siberian tundra where the land has literally exploded and created these huge craters because the methane decomposition is triggering a spark and the methane explodes, creating these. It looks like a meteorite hit the planet when in fact it was climate change that hit it. We're seeing clathrates give off their methane in the oceans at increasing levels. The tundra itself is warming up and decomposing at a faster rate. There's twice as much carbon in the tundra as there is in the sky. So I don't know what it takes. I honestly, Allison, I don't know what it takes to wake up our media. I don't know what it takes to wake up our lawmakers. I don't know what it takes to wake up Americans anymore. I thought all, you know, some, just even a couple of these calamities would trigger this wake-up call, you know, and I felt that way during Hurricane Katrina when a hurricane that was petering out, if you remember, as it crossed over Florida, got into the hot water of the Gulf of Mexico. That water was overheated. It was at least 2 degrees Celsius warmer than it should have been. And when that weakened storm hit that hot water, it turned into a Cat 5 hurricane again. And to me, that was a clear warning that hot water amplifies storms and causes calamity, in this case, over $100 billion plus damage. You'd think that we would get excited and start acting in a responsible way. We didn't, because the politicians and the industry, and it's hard to tell the difference sometimes, but they both have the same message. So, you know, let's not get worried. Let's not. I'm just flabbergasted. So that leads us to where we're at now with the upcoming climate gathering in New York and the things that happen from here forward. There are some really good things happening, and I'd love to get into some of that. For me, one of the greatest things that's happening is that solar energy and batteries are on a their costs are on a rapid downward trajectory, similar to what I experienced when I bought my first computer at $9,000. What was once expensive is no longer. What was once clunky is no longer. Solar and batteries are within a couple of years, are going to overwhelm natural gas and coal, because the costs are on a steep cost curve that's going to produce enormous fruit for everybody. So I'm both really troubled deeply about what's happening and also excited about the possibilities as we look forward.
Great. Thank you. That's really incredible. Also, just wanting to ask, this year also saw new projections from James Hansen, who you mentioned, was originally, he's been the lead scientist on the whole wake-up call around all of this. Can you just give our listeners, some clues about what his latest findings are to add to this mix?
Well, I think Hansen and others have been looking at what I would describe as a non-linear melt of glaciers. The earlier projections for sea level rise were really pretty modest, and now we're looking at much more aggressive increase in sea level. And I think about that when I think about, I live here in Pennsylvania, so I think about Philadelphia. I also, having spent so many years in D.C., think about Washington and Baltimore and, New York and all the other cities that are influenced by tides. Some of them are really far away from the ocean, but they still are greatly influenced by the tidal influences. And that's true in Washington, for example. But we're seeing projections on sea level that are absolutely alarming. We're talking 20 feet. And the reason for these new projections, and they have to be fully vetted, and they're not yet, so I don't want to put a hard number on it, but one of the things that is happening, because we're burning so much forest, because Chinese and others are putting so much particulate matter in the air, we're seeing that soot fall out on Greenland, and there's a scientist by the name of Dr. Box who I recently spoke to about this. When I was in Greenland in 2007, the ice, was a little bit discolored, but you had to really look close, and most of the discoloration was in the black soot that accumulated in these little tiny puddles that existed on the Greenland surface. But if you look at Greenland today, so much of what we're seeing in Greenland is now this black soot that's falling out of the sky and darkening the ice itself. And then because there's organic matter in some of the forest fire products, it stimulates algal growth, and so the algae itself is a brown ice algae that grows. And so what you're seeing is what was once a white surface with fresh replenishments of snow each year is now becoming a dark surface, and so you're shifting from an 80% albedo to something much less than that, in some cases, perhaps half of that. We're seeing the darkening of these ice surfaces, and that's true not just of Greenland, but also of other ice formations. So it accelerates, because it's darkened, it accelerates that melt, that melt is moving at a nonlinear rate that really was outside of the early estimates. I mean, that was not something that they predicted. And then the other aspect of it is the speed at which the Arctic ice is changing. Even though it doesn't increase the sea levels, what it does do is increase the energy in the North Country. So as the ice around the world gets darkened by soot, as we continue to heat up the planet with more and more methane and carbon dioxide leakage, we're seeing this whole thing go into a much more accelerated pace. So what was once considered a problem for the late 21st century and then the 21st century, mid-century, now it's becoming increasingly clear that we're seeing the sea levels rise in a way that's going to have profound impacts on cities. In Miami, for example, we'll have a king tide that probably will bring water into the urban areas, maybe 5-6 inches, maybe a foot of water in some urban areas in Miami. And that's not driven by a storm. That's just simply driven by the tides. Well, you know, you have a king tide and then have a hurricane hit at the same time, you're in serious trouble. And that's, New York City knows what that means. And we just need to be somehow or another communicating to the public that, one, we have a solution to this problem, and it's cheap, and it will actually save us all money long term. I have solar on my home. And right now, I'm running a computer, talking to you on the phone, and doing all the other things that I do in a home, and it's not costing me anything because I've already paid for my solar panel. So, I'm enjoying clean, good energy in a way that we all should be enjoying it. And there are folks out here who don't want us to have that. They don't want us to have a cheaper, cleaner solution to our own future and to the future of our children. And those folks are frankly, and have for a long time dominated the politics of this country.
Mm-hmm. So incredibly short-sighted. I was at eating out in a restaurant last night, and just, the tables are placed close together, and you can't help overhearing, what the people at the next table are saying. And they were the kind of folks that I would not have expected to have any interest in this topic once, whatsoever. And yet they were discussing it. I was kind of amazed. But they were saying, well, we won't see it in my lifetime, so there's, in effect, what happens is that those who are older and in, positions of empowerment of one kind or another who can influence the political process, kind of feel that, there's a kind of get out of jail free card, because they'll have passed from the scene, and they're sort of mildly worried for their grandchildren, or maybe more than mildly worried, maybe seriously worried. I've heard people in despair for the grandchildren on the other side of the coin. Do the new projections, and I know they're not complete yet, but do they indicate that the problems that you're discussing would be happening this century as opposed to 21st century?
Oh yeah, these are projections that are happening now and will happen. They're looking at mid-century or earlier. And when you look at the temperature projections for 2030, for example, which is a mere 15 years away, my home state, we're talking about 5.4 degrees Fahrenheit warmer, and we've already warmed by 1.8 degrees. So we're talking about a huge jump in a 15-year period. And that's going to have incredible. People also think that the oceans just increased because of glacial and Greenland melt and Antarctica melt. But they really increase as a result of temperature. As the Earth warms and as the Earth absorbs this incoming energy, it stores that energy, about 93% of it, in the oceans. And, water molecules, when they get warmer, have to get more space to move. They need more space. That's why pots boil over. So we're seeing that phenomenon in the oceans. As the oceans take in all this extra energy, they expand and increase. And I think we're going to see that happen. Again, that's another part of this whole analysis. It's related to not just the Arctic and the Antarctica and Greenland and the other ice melts, but it's largely related to the warming of our seas. And for a long time, the energy that was coming in from the being trapped by carbon dioxide was not, they didn't know where it was going. And for a number of years, the scientists felt that the temperature was only changing down to 60 meters in the ocean. Mm-hmm. And now, more recently, they found that ocean temperature is actually being altered all the way to the bottom. That
wow.
There's enough mixing going on. So we're basically sending warmer water all the way to the bottom of the ocean. On the good side, it gives us some shock absorber for this extra energy. On the bad side, that energy is not going to behave well. And we're certainly seeing that as storms across ocean waters. Some of the predictions that we're going to see less weak storms and more bigger storms. It's certainly true. And we're seeing that in the Pacific, you know, some of the horrendous storms that people have endured in the Pacific are should be alarm bells, but they're not.
How would you rate, you know, the Obama administration? Because there's a lot of, you know, kind of statements, you know, that have led, you know, environmental leaders, some of them, to be hopeful. For example, in the recent, you know, I did about 6 months of coverage on the trade deals, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, Fast Track, and other trade deals. And these really reset the dial on the global economy and have profound environmental impact. For example, environmental impact and global warming are excluded from being considered in any of the deals. That's one shocking way. They also will affect environmental laws, various kinds of toxic chemical regulation. They will empower a lot of fossil fuel activity. Major, major problems for those of us concerned about the environment. And yet some organizations were, you know, really stepped up and Friends of the Earth, Public Citizen and others, Sierra Club, really, you know, very strong in their opposition. Others were more quiet. And one of the reasons I hypothesized is because they and others, you know, were kind of standing on the sidelines hoping that the president would follow through on his environmental promises and his statements of concern. How well is he doing? How do you rate him? Do you think that his activity or lack of appropriate activity will be a focus in Climate Week?
Well, first of all, I think President Obama has, we've watched over the last six plus years, I should say, President Obama on a learning curve on his own. President Obama started off as a person who acknowledged climate change from the beginning, but who believed that it was possible to have an all of the above energy policy. And he ran on that. I mean, he ran on the idea that we would be increasing the amount of solar and wind, but that we would also rely on oil and coal and all the other traditional pollutants. And so he started off with, I would suggest that he started off with lack of deep understanding of the climate threat. I think that's a fair statement to make. Now, since that time, he has spent time with John Holdren and with you know, the EPA administrators and others, and has gotten a much more profound understanding of climate change. I think that's real. But he also, you know, when he first populated his administration, he populated with people who, frankly, had other agendas. And I think commerce, for example, has been a real driver in the trade agreements that you're talking about. And and so when he turns to a trade question, he turns to his leadership in commerce. And when they're not in sync with climate change, they end up at a different place. And you see this with Interior. I mean, Interior Department, you know, leased offshore oil right during the, you know, the lead up to the BP spill, and since that time have continued to do that. They've leased large blocks of coal in Wyoming, for example. The Powder River coal leases are appalling. I mean, you talk about you know, causing your future to be distorted. Those coal reserves are enormous, and I think the State Department under Hillary Clinton was headed towards approval of the pipelines from the tar sands, and that, you know, that was stopped not because people had a change of heart, but because the political pressures were mounting. And but having said all that, I think the president has finally, you know, come to the realization that we, you know, that all the above isn't working. He doesn't articulate it very well. In fact, you know, the commitments that were made already to Shell, apparently he felt were too far along to pull back from drilling in the Arctic, which I think is the most insane policy you can have. You know, the idea that you go into a highly vulnerable fragile place like the Arctic Ocean, where, you know, storms well up and where ice formations move around. I mean, these big blocks of ice can knock a drilling rig over with no problem whatsoever. And yet, you know, these guys are so brazen that they think they can go up there and do this development and not have harm to our environment. I mean, who are they kidding? They can't even drill in the Gulf of Mexico. So I think we're in for, you know, in for calamity. And I lived through the Exxon Valdez spill, which is just one tanker full of oil. And I visited 20 years later, went back to the same sites where the oil spilled. And the scientists that were doing a study that year, 20 years later, were finding oil in 50% of the sites where they had taken samples from the substrate. So we have oil still sitting in, from the Exxon Valdez spill now, you know, decades later, still doing damage to the ecosystems up there, still preventing the recovery of those waters. And so ecologically, those, you know, that part of the world is going to be changed forever. And it's, the ecological changes take place are not reversible. You just can't turn that switch off and expect it'll recover. And I think if we have spills in the Arctic, we'll see the same pattern. So, you know, it's easy to be critical, but I think what we see is President Obama is a transitional president on climate change, and he's one foot was in the old world and the other foot is in the new world. And I think he shifted his center of gravity to the new world. I think his influence on the G7, for example, saying that we'll have zero carbon by the end of the century, I think they're actually off by 50 years. But I think having them at least politically acknowledge that we're seeing the end, we must see the end of carbon is a big statement. I think his advocacy, his recent tour to promote climate change by visiting various climate affected areas is a really important undertaking. Kutsaba, where he visited, is a place that I did a climate reality talk from during the 24 Hours of Reality with Al Gore. And I spent time in the restaurants and in the community talking to the Native Alaskans that live in Kotzebue, and they were clear. I mean, there wasn't a single person up there had any doubts at all, because they had seen it. In fact, I remember talking to one native hunter who said, you know, today is our first day of caribou hunting. And he said, I can't go out onto the tundra because it's 72 degrees out and the tundra is so mushy. I would perish out there. It's normally frozen. I normally take my snowmobile out there. And he said, I can't do that now. There's no snow. The ground's not frozen. And so I'm sitting here having coffee instead of being out there hunting for food for my family. So they all know. They know these people live in nature. They live and breathe the various weather changes that occur. They know the plant life. They know the animal life. They know the fishery, and they see nature changing dramatically. And so you don't need to tell Alaskan native that there's climate change. They'll tell you, and they'll explain it to you in ways that will open your eyes.
You know, there's such a contrast between that and the way we live in so-called civilized society, where we're, you know, plugged into computers, we're looking at numbers in terms of, you know, as a benchmark for how much we're succeeding, you know, the monetary system, et cetera, and we're really, you know, we're really not that clued in. I mean, one thing that I often hear is that some people have the idea that climate change is a liberal myth. It's a fantasy that people came up. What I've never understood is, what is the purpose of the fantasy? Why would anyone have this fantasy? Does someone make money by having the fantasy? Is it just a weak idea? But it's very widely, I mean, there are a lot of people who have been misled into believing this. your comments on that?
Well, I shared a story in my book. I wrote a book, you may remember, called Last Chance Preserving Life on Earth. And
yes.
One of the stories I told in that book was I was flying to San Francisco from Washington, D.C., and there was a young boy sitting next to me. He had a tag on his shirt that was intended for his father. His mother was sending him to California for the summer with his father. But anyway, mm-hmm. he was sitting next to me in the window, and we were on the left side of the plane, and the pilot came on as we were flying over the Grand Canyon, and he said, folks, he said, this is a gorgeous day out there, and we're flying over the Grand Canyon. He said, and I've been flying this route for many years. He said, it was the most magnificent sight that I've seen. Look out your left window and look at the Grand Canyon and all of its splendor. And I looked over, and this boy was playing his little Game Boy device that he had been playing since we took off. And he never once raised his eyes. He never once lifted up his eyes to look out the window at the Grand Canyon. And to me, that was a very symbolic thing, because we have allowed our children to become so disconnected from nature, so mm-hmm. disconnected from the natural world, that they actually do not believe that we have any obligation or any risk. If nature goes south, we're okay. This mm-hmm. is a prevailing attitude. And then they go off to college and they get a business degree because that's where you make your money, and they don't get any environmental education in college or in high school or in grade school, many places. And so these kids are growing up without any, you know, their ecological knowledge and their environmental scores are zero. You know, if you were to give them a test on those things, you would find that they all flunk. And I think that is a parental problem. I think we as parents need to connect our children with nature. I have five grandsons, and I try to do my part to get them into nature. And my one grandson knocked on my door one day, and he had two toads in his hand. He was a big smile, and to me, that's really special, because, you know, he loves those toads, and he's now understanding where they come from and what they mm-hmm. eat, and he goes into my library and gets out my nature books and reads them, and I want him to love nature. I want him to have a heart for nature, so that when he grows up, he and his fellow youngsters will have a love for these things that they need to care for. And mm-hmm. I think that's a fundamental problem, which also leads me to what's happening in Climate Week this year. And I think mm-hmm. with the Pope's visit, I think the climate fight has moved from the science to the spiritual to the moral. And mm-hmm. and I think it's been a long overdue shift, that the mm-hmm. moral leaders of the world, including the Pope and many, many others, others have been at it for a long time. The National Religious Partnership for the Environment has been around since the mid-90s, for example. But, you know, moral leaders are finally breaking through and helping people understand that we have a moral obligation to our kids. We have a moral obligation to our children's future. And I think that is starting to finally penetrate. And I think I give the Pope an A+ for calling it out, and for calling out in such clear and accurate terms. You know, he is drawing on his science team. There's a Pontifical Academy of Science that people don't hear about very often. But, you know, the Catholic Church has a rigorous science team up there, and he knows what's going on, and they know what's going on at the top. Now, will that trickle down to the priests in the pulpits on Sunday? I don't know, but I know this, that the Pope is a clarion voice for these urgent issues. And I think the President has become increasingly an urgent voice, and that has probably helped, you know, in many places wake up, and certainly has forced the media to pay a little more attention to it. But, you know, they have their oil interests that by advertising, and they've been reticent. But it's really hard to be reticent when the President is talking about it and you're covering his travels. So I give the President high marks for taking these steps to try to get the word out. The fact that we have EPA regulations that are trying to break through and push change at the state level is a good thing. So, you know, you know, I was very critical of the oil drilling. I was critical of the way the BP spill was handled by the Coast Guard, including the spraying of chemicals on the water that were made it more toxic and sinking the oil to the basement. I think that there's been a change at the White House, and I think it's a good change, and we should, give him credit for stepping up. I worry about 2016, to be honest with you. I know Bernie Sanders, I've spent enough time with Sanders when he was, actively working on these issues to know that he gets his stuff and he understands how urgent it is. But I, to be honest with you, I'm not confident that the other, the Republicans are completely off the charts. I don't know how someone like Bush or, some of these others can put a straight face say the things that they say about climate change when in fact they live in states and have seen the consequences of severe storms and flooding and the temperature changes that are occurring.
It's alarming and it's fast approaching. I personally find it so far-fetched that Trump could be a candidate that I'm basically electively ignoring the entire spectacle. I just don't believe that the powers that be on any side of this, would not be supporting that, no matter that people, believe that some positive change could come from that kind of an approach. So for once, I'm trusting in the fact that people of influence who have their hands on our government and are creating so many of these detriments that we're discussing would not allow this one ultimately to occur because it would be too unmanageable. So I'm therefore ignoring it and, thinking beyond that in terms of what we'll actually be having to deal with. But I could be proven wrong.
That's probably good for your mental health because it's not been one of my favorite political seasons. Let's put it that way. I just am appalled by some of the things that people seem to. What I'm more appalled about is it seems to evoke a positive response from voters, and I just don't get that. America is better than that. Our nation has always done well when we pulled together and when we worked together. When we say we're united, my father fought in the Second World War, served in the Second World War, and I remember some of the comments that many of the soldiers made in those days, how good they felt about being so united. And the idea that we are dividing ourselves and labeling each other and creating these schisms that are really unhealthy. And I think in the long haul, we'll bring America down. I don't think we can survive. We'll either stand as one nation or we'll fall as a bunch of splinter interest groups like so many parts of the world. If you look where the problems are, everywhere there is division and splintering and hatred, you end up with a broken system. And I think there are folks working hard to break our system, and we should not let them do that. So for me, these are all intertwined issues. And frankly, a lot of the dark money is being spent to try to divide America because they know we can't solve problems when we're divided. They know that is true, and that's why they work hard at doing that. And I don't know how we get that message across, but that's what's going on here. There are folks who want to keep status quo, want to keep their power base, want to keep things in control, and they do so by diverting people in the blind alley issues that are not productive.
I was having a conversation with a healthcare professional that I know, and onto this topic. And this is someone who has, all the while that I've been doing my reporting, and he's aware of it, hasn't really, had any interest in anything like that. He regarded it as politics. too complicated, too worrisome, didn't really want to focus on any of that. But recently, whenever I see this provider, you know, the topic is this most flamboyant candidate. And you know, it's kind of like if you... it's hard, and people are busy, and due to the economy, people are pressed, and therefore they don't have time to really kind of drill into issues. So, you know, if a clown comes out on the public stage and entertains them, you know, then it's stimulating and it's engaging, and they can kind of feel entertained and like they're watching something that's dynamic, where they may be overtired or exhausted by the, you know, the economic drivers that make life hectic and worrisome for so many people, you know. So then you have this form of entertainment coming out. So, you know, I wish that people, you know, there would be ways to more clearly and easily convey some basic kind of home truths in an entertaining manner, so that people were not so, and of course this was the role of the comedians. I mean, the two prime television media comedians who were also cultural critics have gone off the air this year, and in place now we have a clown on the political stage, you know. So, you know, this says to me that people are exhausted. They need, you know, they're seeking entertainment and stimulation, something easy. And, you know, our issues are complex. So, you know, yes. I think we have to kind of step into the middle of that and create something engaging that answers some of this need, while also educating people, you know, to the real realities.
Well, your comment about being complex are absolutely on mark. You know, I find it fascinating. If those of us who remember Ronald Reagan's run for the White House, Reagan didn't. Reagan had all these little lines that he would use, but he really was almost absent on what the policies were, because he knew that policies don't get people elected. It's the charisma. And that's what I see going on here with Trump, and the game that he's been able to play successfully is to make these statements, you know, many of them outrageous, and no one really questions that, because they don't want to dig too deep, and I think one of the problems that we've had is that our subject is a very complex one. And, mm-hmm. you know, we can turn it into simple statements, one-sentence statements, and put some pith to it. We'd probably get some attention, but that's not been done to date. And so as a result, it's easy to dismiss us, you know. Mm-hmm. Even President Obama, when he spoke at, Senator Harry Reid has an annual climate conference in Nevada, and the president spoke at it. He made this statement. He said, solar panels aren't just for tree huggers anymore. Mm-hmm. And in saying that, you know, I'm sure he didn't mean it this way, but he used the framing that the opposition has used against us. Yeah, I love trees. I don't deny that I have a deep love for forests and for healthy trees. But, mm-hmm. Being called a tree hugger is a pejorative in many circles, and particularly mm-hmm. in the West. And mm-hmm. so when you make those kind of statements, it really sticks. And so I think there's a lot of work that needs to be done on messaging and how we communicate these issues, and how our politicians address them. And mm-hmm. and I think we ought to be working hard at, you know, Frank Luntz tells the Republicans how to word things. And he's been a master at that. Even though he knows that climate change is a real threat, he actually approached Al Gore one day and told Al that he understood climate change was a threat, and asked Al if there's something he could do, which was I think a way to heal his own conscience, because he's been telling Republicans how to spin this story in all sorts of ways that have caused them to be able to avoid accountability for their utter failures. But anyway, we need a messenger that's better than Frank Luntz that can help coach all of us on how to communicate more mm-hmm. effectively to the average person who does not have the time for the complexities.
Yep. I think that's really true. Let's just talk a bit about your work at Penn Future. You know, what you're up to there and what the goals that you're working with at that organization and your new role there.
Well, first of all, I committed to my wife and to my family that I would spend 10 years at National Wildlife Federation. So I was finished May 2014 at NWF, and it was during that time I worked hard at trying to build national momentum for climate change. And more recently, I've joined Penn Future, which is an organization that has long held climate change as a priority and has been very active in a number of legislative and also legal fights over things like fracking. Pennsylvania, as you know, is one of the biggest gas producers now because of this technique called fracking, and because the state has had it in the past a very hands-off approach to these practices. There's a lot of problems, and the industry itself has worked really hard at convincing Pennsylvanians that our future is in gas, that that's mm-hmm. Gas is going to fix everything that's a problem, you know, and the advertising is ubiquitous. And so as a result, and also the money that has floated to the lawmakers has been enormous. And so you have lawmakers and political leaders, and the advertising and the media itself has gotten on board, you know, and everybody says, well, gas is the answer. Well, gas is the answer if carbon is not the problem. But carbon is a problem, and when you put gas in the sky, you know, it may, if we control methane, it may reduce those numbers slightly, but certainly not on the trajectory that we need to be on in order to avoid a catastrophic loss. So mm-hmm. we have a problem here in Pennsylvania, and that's really what I want to work on, is help people, one, understand that clean energy is going to be cheaper energy than gas, and clean energy can meet our needs for much of what we currently use today. And coupled with efficiency and with other techniques, we can get to a better future, and we can do that in a responsible way. Pennsylvania is the third largest emitter of carbon as a state. Texas is well on its way to a new energy economy because of wind, and more recently there's $1 billion solar plant going in West Texas, and I think you'll see a lot more of that in the days ahead. Texas is getting there by the energy costs and by the availability of wind and other things. So the number two emitter is going to be going down. The number one emitter is California, and as you know, they're on a fast track to a cleaner future. So Pennsylvania will stick out as the heel dragger if we're not careful. And mm-hmm. I want to work very hard to prevent that from being the case. Pennsylvania, the governor of Pennsylvania, is committed to achieving the goals set by EPA, and we want to help him to do that. I think it's a bold step on his part, and I want to, you know, reinforce that everywhere I go. And so I'm going to put more and more of my time and attention at the state level, because, you know, we moved the ball from the federal level to the states. The game is now at the state level, and there are now 50 battles for our climate future, not one. And so mm-hmm. we need to win all 50 of those battles.
Mhm. Mhm. Yeah, that's interesting. That's really fascinating. I mean, in taking on, you know, the laggard state as you are, that's really an amazing challenge. And no one, you know, as a native Pennsylvanian and with your incredible commitment to the environment and leadership over, you know, so many decades, it's really great to hear that you're in that spot. And, you know, it's just fantastic. So, you know, I really salute you for that and wish you, you know, great success with all of that. But one of the things that I often wonder, because I happen to, this was in the food movement, I happened to make a statement where there was a win in one particular county on a certain issue, but meanwhile, federally, there has been, you know, like massive regression, and there's been many losses on state-by-state initiatives in this particular issue. You know, and I commented when this particular county made, a positive move forward, gee, you know, that's nice, but it's too bad that we're, you know, regressing in all these other areas. So, you know, and this brings up a bigger question, which is, what is the role for local and what is the role for global or for national? Because, you know, the sense that, you know, to me, on the one hand, there's an advantage in local advocacy and engagement because the people know each other and they're not abstract issues. This is the community and the natural setting in which we live. We certainly saw that in the fracking battles that have gone on and continue to go on in New York State as well as in Pennsylvania. But on the other hand, if we lose the national battles, we're sort of beaten back to the local front, that many more people have to get it and have to be organized. I mean, I would just love to hear your thoughts on that. You know, a lot of people, when we lose a national battle, will say, oh, we'll do it on a local level. Not always so that easy, often very complicated and challenging. What are your thoughts on the role of local versus national versus global as you know, the kind of front for organizing?
Well, let me suggest that it's impossible to build a skyscraper from the sky down. It just doesn't
right.
work. And we have for, since, you know, really before even Kyoto, before the Kyoto Agreement, have been aiming at getting a global treaty, you know, an enforceable global structure to force everybody to comply with a similar pattern of rules. And that has not worked. You know, doing that at the global level has not worked. Although no one is willing to write off Paris, I would certainly not write off Paris. But my expectations of what comes out of that are altered by what I know needs to happen. And that is that we need to win this fight at every local and every state and every national level. And we can do that only if we do a lot of groundwork, you know, helping people in our communities, helping people in our neighborhoods, helping people in our cities, and helping farmers understand what is in store and helping them understand what is available for opportunities. That work needs to be done at every level, and no mm-hmm. single person can do it. It needs mm-hmm. to be it needs to be built from the ground up. You know, Robert Frost wrote a poem many years ago about the builder building his chimney from the ground up. You know, he didn't want his chimney built on a shelf. I don't know if you remember that poem, but quite a powerful poem, and it really speaks to me at this moment because we need to build this fight from the ground up. We need a good mm-hmm. foundation. We need brick by brick to build a common solution. That doesn't mean we don't need an international treaty. We do. We need an international agreement. And, you know, whether it has teeth in it or not is not the point. It's a collective commitment to action. And I think we need that, but we also, you know, should not lose our focus on that local, that state, and that national level. I think when the people lead, the leaders will follow. I believe that that is true. You know, in 1970 on Earth Day, I watched an upwelling. I was a part of an upwelling here in Pittsburgh, actually, where, you know, mm-hmm. where students and others were marching on the streets wearing gas masks, carrying a coffin. And I took a group of students to see the last nesting bald eagle and told them about Rachel Carson's concerns. And mm-hmm. In Harrisburg, there were 5,000 people on the steps of the Capitol building. And in Philadelphia, there's a huge Earth Day event. It's still on the Internet. You can find it. But the upwelling that people created in those days caused 86 lawmakers in Harrisburg to go away, and we had a new green legislature. I went to work in 1971 as a result of that Earth Day upwelling, and I, you know, my career has been has been formed by that experience. So I believe very strongly in the individual leading and empowering people at their home level to make a difference and win every conversation. I get people on my Facebook page comment, well, I don't want to create that negativity or get into an argument. You have to win the arguments. It's up to us to win those arguments at those social gatherings. You know, people say, don't talk about politics or religion when you're having a social evening. I disagree. I think it's time, you know, when people make stupid statements about environmentalists or about protecting the environment or about climate change, you know, they need to be challenged on that, and they need to be told that this is not the way it is. And soon they'll go silent, and then soon the better voices will emerge. But we need to win the battle and not let the other side, dominate as they have for so long.
No, I agree with you about that. And also, if you're not discussing these things that you just mentioned, then what are you talking about exactly? You know, it's like with everything that's going on, there is this notion, you know, of polite society that, you know, which doesn't discuss these things, that dates back to a more suppressed, contained, milder time than the one we're in. I've had to do this. You know, sometimes I'm kind of like, if I'm finding myself bored in a conversation because, you know, I'll persist and even, you know, hang out with some folks in order to say one thing, you know, so they'll hear something different. But, you know, but you also, I think people need their core group of people that are on the same page and that can talk about these kinds of things together. So that, you know, it's, and I think that's also very important in this movement. It's one of the things we've had in the fracking movement, you know, because otherwise you're constantly speaking to the uninitiated, and that, you know, that serves a role, but it also can become depleting. That's been my own experience. So,
well, it's interesting you say, because I just recently went to and spoke at the R-Day conference out in Colorado, and Chip and Sally do a really outstanding job with that program, but what it does for me is it brings all the top climate advocates and leaders and scientists and others and funders and others together in a way that is really healthy, because we, you know, these are not people that need to be convinced. These are people who are doing the convincing, and we share notes and compare, and I find that to be extraordinarily helpful to me because it does recharge your battery, but also reminds you that you're not in this fight alone, that there are a lot of other really talented and good people out there working hard in their own ways and their own spheres of influence to change the conversation.
Yeah, and then you learn different tools and different kinds of ways of framing and all of that kind of thing, too, just naturally by listening to people. Yeah, that's really helpful.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, it absolutely is.
Fascinating. Well, this has been, as usual, a great conversation. We'll look forward to what happens in upcoming Climate Week in New York, the 21st through 28th of September. People can go if they want to attend any of these events. If you see environmentalists in town, welcome them, New Yorkers. We're happy to have you amongst us. And we will check back in with you, Larry Schweiger of Penn Future, CEO and President of Penn Future, on what transpired with Climate Week to keep the Connect the Dots listeners updated on all climate developments. Thank you for being on Connect the Dots and for all the fine work and the leadership that you provide.
Well, and the same back to you, Alice. I appreciate your leadership and your commitment to this cause.
Well, it's the big one. It's the big one.
Thank you,
listeners, for being with us for another edition of Connect the Dots. Tune back in for our next show with Larry Schweiger, and you can check the archives for past shows with Larry and others talking about climate, as well as subscribe to my newsletter at healthjournalistblog.com to receive announcements of upcoming radio programs. Be back with us next week at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network for the next edition of Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy. Be well.